Ghost Dice Podcast, where we discuss Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition. This is Episode 3, and I'm your host, Paul Rorschach-Tobin. With me tonight is the co-founder, Jesse Gitzman-Burke.
Hello.
And we've also got Dan Crimson Avenger Carrick.
Hello.
And returning back from a short leave of absence, Jeremy Malevolus Duval.
Hey, guys.
All right, so here we are back at a third episode, 3 for 3 now, continuing to move forward. I think we've got a good episode for you here. We've got our regular segments. We're going to start out with the news. Then we're going to go into our system spotlight, which is about action cards and actions that you take in the game. And then our main topic that we really want to focus on is the first of the ruinous powers that we're going to talk about. So the four chaos gods that are kind of the big, big bads of the Warhammer world. And this one we're going to start off with Tzeentch. And then we'll wrap things up with the question and answer. So, anything to kick it off, guys, or are we just going to get right into the news?
Should we debate how to pronounce Tzeentch for a while?
Ooh, yeah.
Tzeentch? Was this the OG?
Oh my god.
Way to say Tzeentch.
Yeah,
that's right.
You've been Tzeentched. You're done.
It took me a while to figure this one out. It's probably one of the harder ones to say, and probably the most common one to mispronounce.
Hey,
they fly around on evil demonic surfboards, which is a bonus.
Well, you could always check him up on Facebook and see how he pronounces it.
That's
yes.
True. I did talk to a librarian. She was very helpful in pronunciation, so I was very excited about that.
That was probably a very strange librarian.
Yeah. She did have some blueness in her eyes. I wasn't going to question anything, but, you know.
All right, so let's get going. The first thing in the news that we've got is that the first content from Fantasy Flight Games for 2011 has been officially released since last episode, and that's called The Witch's Song, which is a new adventure that they've got out. Jesse, I know you and I, as GMs, we've taken a look at it.
We have.
Jeremy and Dan, you guys probably haven't, and I want to make sure this is a spoiler-free overview, so players, please feel free to continue listening. So
just to kind of go over the basics, though, we're not necessarily going to be covering the contents of the box, because that is very spoiler-rich. Suffice to say, it's got some cool stuff. You do get two new careers, a basic and advanced version of the of a witch and a warlock. But the story and the adventure is really what is the focus of this module.
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, there's a couple things that you get in here. You know, there's the general stuff that you get from all the adventures. You get a handful of new miscast cards, condition cards, locations, item cards, you know, just kind of that extra stuff, different critical wounds, things like that, talents, you know, stuff to kind of round things out. But really the focus of this is the actual adventure itself, which is very good. I really like the way that it definitely captures the Warhammer world. I mean, everything is covered in crap, smells like crap, people are downtrodden, and oh my god, here comes the horrors, you know? So it's not just bad enough that you're living in the medieval setting, but now somebody's gonna, you know, steal your soul.
Now, I have a question. First off, what was the price, and secondly, would you consider it worth the price that you paid for it?
I forget what the price is.
I think it was $30. It might have been $35. Regarding is it worth it? This adventure is not one for introductory players. First off, this is certainly one for the guys who have been run through a full campaign or at least a handful of adventures. The complexity of it is not, you know, terribly hard, but the core content of it is can be a little dangerous for new players, is probably the only way I could put it without really getting too much into the specifics. But one thing I really love is it focuses on witches and witchcraft, obviously, from the title, but it also focuses on the powers that oppose witches and specifically witch hunters. It really, and that's such a huge component, witch hunters and witchcraft, of the Warhammer world. It's really nice to have an entire adventure which really just encapsulates the whole concept beautifully.
Yeah, it's basically, I mean, if you take a look at the cover, that's Matthias is on there. He's kind of one of the central figures of it. He's the witch hunter, and the dude's got a brazier on his head. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy's head is on fire. So
he's like half
off,
bright
he's
wizard.
Badass.
He's like half bright wizard.
He's the equivalent of a badass. That's what we're trying to say. Gotcha.
Absolutely. Really, what it does is, I mean, I'll talk in generalization about what the adventure is about. I mean, it's basically, it's your little podunk town in the Empire.
Which is located up near Marienburg, right?
Right. And that's actually one of my issues with the adventure is that it is geographic specific. So it will be very difficult, and I'm not going to go into why, but it'll be very difficult for you to take it out of that particular geographic location and say put it outside Ubersreich if that's where your campaign is.
But I do like that they're leaving that Reichland area finally. Mm-hmm. It's nice to see they're starting to tap into the different cultural areas aside from Reichland and Altdorf. I mean, they've had fun and they're very generic adventures so far, but you know, maybe in the future we're going to start seeing, you know, some of the other areas like Kislev or the Border Princes or things like
that. So could you see that there might be a cool opportunity for a GM to maybe do like a entry sort of afternoon kind of figuring out how everyone's character got to this location?
It's definitely, if you've got an experienced group of people, it's definitely good for a one-shot. I mean, okay. You can probably wrap up the adventure in, I mean, depending on how long your sessions are, maybe 2 or 3 sessions, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's great for a one shot. And it's set up that your party is on the way to Marienburg and you run into a priest of Sigmar and he's heading down to Altdorf because the folks in Marienburg don't believe in Sigmar as much as he thinks they believe in Sigmar. So screw that. He's leaving the Free Town and heading down to where the Empire actually is. And he's looking for help because they found a witch and the witch killed a person and he's looking for help. So then the party goes to this town.
He basically asks the party to go to the town to check it out while he continues his journey because he needs somebody dealing with the issue yesterday.
Well, he's reporting to his superiors, right? Mm-hmm. He's going to find a lector or an archlector and tell them what's going on. So you guys head in there, but as he continues traveling down the Reich, the next person he runs into is the witch hunter. So it sets this up in the whole adventure that there's kind of 3 factions that you're dealing with. There's the townsfolk, there's the nobility, the von Stauffers, who actually run the town, and then there's the witch hunter and his zealot posse, basically, that rolls into town. And it kind of puts the party in the middle of all that. And oh, by the way, there's, you know, marshes with beasts in it and all sorts of other weird stuff and a witch out there too.
Now, Jer, you know a lot about the witch hunters. I mean, they're kind of like one of the classic core elements separate from
Definitely.
Chaos that really are the main focus of the Warhammer world.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like the kind of the other side of the coin of extremities. You have the evil of chaos, and then you have the witch hunters, you know, which are just as intense, but in like the other spectrum.
I mean, they're like, know, once... so good, they're bad.
Oh, yeah.
They're
like,
psychotic.
Even that's what's so great about the Warhammer world is even the good guys are kind of like crazy, you know, because these guys are so fanatical that they even hear a hint of you being a witch, they're going to come after you with awesome episodes.
And that's kind of the main theme of the adventure is what happens. You found a witch. These guys need help. But the witch hunter comes in and his brand of help may not be the same brand that the party has.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So it's good stuff. It's definitely, I mean, if that interests you, the extra stuff, you know, like I said, my problems with it is that, you know, it's not transferable. It's pretty much stuck geographically where it's at. The witch and warlock stuff, you know, it's not a big deal.
It's not a selling point, but it's nice to have.
It isn't really. The mechanics that they use for witchcraft are pretty. I mean, it's basically 2 careers and takes up 1 sheet of the book. Talks about witchcraft.
Mm-hmm. So you get a set of spells and you get the other kind of core elements of it. But
no, you do get a decent number of hedge magic spells, about 10.
So
one thing we
should cover though is what hedge magic is as opposed to any of the schools of magic elsewhere in Warhammer. You know, Jer, what's your description of the difference between, you know, a bright wizard who goes to the bright college in Altdorf versus a hedge wizard?
I mean, yeah, usually a person who goes to a college is most often from not coming from an aristocratic family who attends a college, and then while attending that college, they are held to the rules of that particular school of magic. You know, they learn its practices, its traditions, its spells. And, you know, mm-hmm. and your hedge wizard is probably, you know, you're kind of apostate or whatever you want to call it. Maybe she was a medicine woman. She was her local mm-hmm, village's
exactly.
witch doctor or whatever. And she discovered a way to sort of handle her magic herself. And now, you know, is trying to help her people or, you know, kind of do their adventure. And, you know, they got to stay under the radar, you know, from the Inquisition or from witch hunters or, you know. So
absolutely.
It's kind of, I would see that as the main difference.
Yeah, so like the medicine woman in town,
yeah.
the oracle, the crazy wizard who lives out in the woods, all those guys are
the guy who
can witch.
Predict the weather, you know.
Right.
Or
those are all great examples of hedge magic or places to use hedge magic. It's the unsanctioned magic of the Empire.
Good. So I think that kind of wraps up, you know, what Witch's Song is about. Some other things out there in the news. We've mentioned in previous episodes Liber Fanatica, which is the fan-driven additional content for Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, both second edition and third edition. 7 is already out. We've talked about that. And 8 is actually underway. We'll have links in the show notes. They just announced a project director, and they're going to get started with that. So if anybody out there has any ideas or has some good adventures or any other kind of fan-related material, look these guys up. Give them a shout out, send them an email, and maybe you can get in this supplement.
You know, it's actually my understanding one of the guys I was talking with earlier this week is developing some content for issue number 8, which is actually about dangers and adventures that you can have on the road in between locations of adventures. So that'll be a nice tie-in when somebody's getting ready to do Witch's Song if you need to move your group over there. He's got a lot of nice tables and fun adventure hooks to kind of keep that journey interesting.
That's good. I wonder if 8's, I know that there's some talk about potentially having a theme for the whole issue. So we'll see how that goes. And then, of course, we've got our part of the news where we pimp Jesse's site.
Jesse gets pimpified.
Yep.
The unintentional pimp factor. Yeah.
Oh,
we're gonna poppy call it.
Yep.
I try and be humble about it.
So you're, and I know you get angry at me if I don't give it the full title, your super huge detailed map of the Warhammer Old World, you've listened to the masses and it's now in full screen capability.
It is.
Right?
I added a link for full screen and set it up such that you can put it now on an iPad or put it up on your TV or all the measuring tools are still intact when you're doing it in full screen. So hopefully you guys enjoy that. That was... it looks pretty cool when you put it up on a big screen.
It's, now, is there any plans to do? I know it's kind of outside of some of the content coming out for roleplay, but do you have any plans to do the Elf Islands or the Dark Elf Sea?
You know,
or
I'd love
other areas.
I'd love to. I think I'm currently working on version 1.1, which is going to be my first major update to the one that's out there right now, where I'm revamping Sylvania, Kislev, Mootland. And then also adding several locations that are mentioned in the Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay 3rd Edition books. Mm-hmm. So once that rolls out, it is my understanding that all the maps that I've been able to get my hands on have all been incorporated or at least decided which one was the most current and appropriate and have been folded into the map. So it should be content complete at that point. I'm taking a break, and then maybe I'll come back to it later.
Oh, come on, Jess. You don't want to donate another 356 hours to this? Come on.
Gitzman's tired.
You must please the masses. Come on, man. You are God. We are your disciples.
I moved on to making the... because the map was getting a little cumbersome, I did move on and published the fillable expanded character sheet as a PDF, and that has a lot of intelligence behind the forms. You can track your stress and fatigue. It'll auto-calculate a lot of your data. All the weapon drop-down fields will pre-populate your weapon statistics into the form. You can save it within Adobe Reader, so you will not need a full copy of Adobe Acrobat to actually, you know, save your form, and you don't have to refill it out each time. So definitely check that out. It's pretty cool.
So that's good, especially if you're playing either componentless, which is the light version, and also if you're playing online too. So, you know, keeping all that kind of there. I mean, I know when I play a map tool game, I like to put the components out and kind of keep them in a tuck box and things like that. But longer term, kind of archiving your characters, you don't necessarily want to keep, you know, 15 tuck boxes lying around for each one of your characters that you've got. So it's a good way to put up not just PCs, but for the GM, for Nemesis level NPCs.
I think I have to disagree on that. Jesse loves the boxes, so he's probably got, what, Jesse, 30 boxes going for your characters?
Oh, it only comes with 3. I like those little character boxes, the good quality thick boxes. I mean, everybody gets a hard on for those things. Those are cool.
You mean like the vault boxes?
Yes.
The
vault
boxes.
Yeah, those are pretty. Those are.
It's hard not to love those. you sell them separately and you're going to buy a couple of them.
All right, we're going to take a break. And then on the other side, we're going to come back with our system spotlight and action cards. Okay, we're back, and we're going to have the System Spotlight segment of the podcast right now. And this episode, we want to talk about action cards. Last episode, we talked about one of the real core components, which was dice. And I think the follow-on from that is another one of those core components of the mechanics of playing Warhammer 3rd Edition, which is the action cards. So it's a little bit different from some of the other role-playing games. It's pretty close to D&D 4th edition. D&D 4th edition, you have your powers, and each power is set up so that these are what you do during your turn. And action cards are the exact same way. When you're in encounter mode, or even when you're in story mode, if you want to do something, what you can do, or the special abilities that you can do, are represented by these action cards. Now there's... Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so what are the different action types? I mean, I know that there's...
So there's basic actions. So everybody's got the set of basic actions that are out there, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other action cards are actually purchased either through character advancement or a character creation. And they're broken down into the different types that you were talking about, Dan. There's melee, ranged, spells, and blessings. And then support cards. So those are basically the 5 types of cards. And then there's basically 2 special classes that I'll talk about too. One is defenses, and the other one is ongoing. So,
got it.
Just to throw a little caveat into the basic actions for clarification, all players get all those basic actions, but a few of those actions may require a certain statistic threshold to be able to use. So things like parry or block, and some of those have some requirements that maybe not all non-melee classes will meet.
Absolutely. And there are also, the actions are dependent as well. There's particular requirements that you have to satisfy to be able to use an action. And that's actually, so this is kind of where a little bit of the Fantasy Flight games and the Warhammer as a board game thing kind of comes into it, because on one hand, these things are very easy to use, but on the other hand, it does make it look like a collectible card game. and the cards are laid out almost like a collectible card game. I mean, you've got the little action type icon that shows whether it's a melee or a spell or what have you. There's a big title up at the top. Some really nice artwork that's put into it.
Well, and Fantasy Flight's very well known for that. I mean, I think what they want to do was to stick to something that they were very good at. And their CCG games are very well thought out, well put together, and I think that's why you see that with their action cards. You know, they actually want to create something you could physically hold and put down and use. So...
But it's a really great tool, because it's very easy for you to browse through them and see what are your options and what's your capabilities. So when it comes around to your turn, you've basically got a handful of cards, and you can say, okay, I can do this, or I can do this, or I can do this, and you lay down the card, and everything's right there. You know, one of the things that I love about this game is that all the rules are right there.
Exactly. So, you don't have to reference through the book. I mean, especially for a new guy like me, I don't have to go through trying to find each page. I just flip to the back, and it tells me exactly what that action does.
So. I found during character creation it to actually be very, very cumbersome to
and intimidating to say, okay, well, pick your three actions, and you're sitting here with a stack of 250 cards.
Yeah,
and actually, you're like, here, look through and read all these and pick three.
That's interesting that you say that, because I was going to actually say the exact opposite of that.
Really?
And so was I, because go ahead, Jeremy, and I know.
Yeah, I was just going to say that was one of the one of the more enjoyable aspects of character creation for me, is that I get this cool stack of abilities to look through. And, you know, it's like, often it's like, okay, what picture do I like? Okay, is it a cool ability? Is it actually useful?
Well, it's not just that, but you're also getting to fully kind of put your thoughts into your character. And, like, I want to be able to do this. I want to be able to do that. And it makes it very easy. And, you know, also sometimes other players or GMs will help you out. But I kind of like that aspect of being able to choose and read through everything, so...
I think I was paralyzed by the amount of options.
Well, and I'll definitely agree with Jesse, because one of the things that, and Fantasy Flight's even pretty explicit about it, is that there isn't a whole lot of organization to the cards. The cards are, of course, defined by those different action categories, but once you get past those action categories, it's kind of open up to anything. I mean, there's specific traits or keywords that are on each card, and those are kind of related to each other. So there's like active defense is a trait, or there's even specific things like Way of the Sword for sword masters. There's ancestor rituals or stuff like that. You know, there's all these little traits that are there, but how do you organize them? Do you put them in alphabetical order? Do you put them in difficulty order? Do you put them in requirements or things like that? So it's a little confusing with that.
I think at some point we'll have to do a segment on just storing your components. I know that's a big thing for a lot of people.
It also helps if you have a GM that's played numerous games and seen numerous people throw their actions, because then when you go to their game, and if you're first person out, you know, not knowing the game, they can kind of help you be like, hey, you might want to think of something like this and throw out a couple action cards and say, these, you know, I would choose one from these five, you know, maybe because it's going to help you with this type of a situation. So, you know, I think there are ways to make it a little easier. But yes, I do agree. Once you pull out the huge deck, you know, maybe if I was tossed that, I would be a little intimidated too. But if you have a GM or other people that have played, and they might be able to give you helpful hints, I think it might not be as cumbersome as you think.
So. I found putting it into a card holder like you would for your old Magic cards or something like that, that makes browsing through the cards much, much less intimidating.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and the card holder is good because they're transparent, because both sides count.
Yeah.
So, you know, you actually get twice as many actions than you think you have, because there's the green side, which is the conservative side, and then on the flip side is the reckless side. Now, not every action is separate from one side to the other, especially things like the basic actions, whether you're doing a melee strike in a conservative stance or a reckless stance, it's going to be the same thing. But a lot of these actions actually have different effects and different side effects, depending on whether you're in the reckless or conservative stance.
Absolutely. You know, I think some of the best examples are... you know, like a lot of the ranged weapons that, you know, you might take time to do an aim shot, and doing an aim shot while in a reckless stance does not necessarily yield the same benefits as taking your time conservatively to do an aim shot. You might have a chance for increased benefits, like increased damage or increased side effects.
Well, you know, I have a question, since we are talking about the whole reckless thing. You know, that was one thing that did kind of confuse me, because never really, when I played my first game, was I like, well, what does reckless do? So, I mean, maybe you guys might be able to explain. You know,
I think we're going to, as our next feature spotlight, we're going to do, we are going to cover the stances and how those kind of affect gameplay, rolling. And
yeah, because I think, especially for new players, understanding they're, you know, pushing too far to reckless, what those advantages and disadvantages are, and pushing too far to not reckless, you know, I think that would kind of play
out. Well, I think the thing that we talked about kind of when we talked about dice as well, is that going into a stance is always more beneficial. There's just from a probability standpoint, the more you go into reckless or conservative, the better chance you have of being successful at the test that you're doing. Because basically, when you look at the raw probabilities of the dice, characteristic dice basically have a 1 in 2 chance of getting one success. The conservative dice actually have a 7 in 10 chance of getting at least one success, and the reckless dice have actually the capability of getting more than one success on a die roll, which is, so it's still 5 out of 10 that you'll get one success, but there's more chance that you'll actually get two successes out of one die. The only detriment is that there's the potential for some side effects, and we kind of talked about that again with the dice, where you get either fatigue or stress from a reckless standpoint, or you get delayed from the conservative side. But you always want to be more in your stance as you can possibly be, and there's actually some mechanics in the game that'll push you back towards neutral, which is never a good thing. So
kind of to represent the ebb and flow of your character getting into the combat, or getting, you know, going all bloodlusty and, you know, going full on reckless, you know, if there's nothing to fight, it's hard to keep that fighting momentum going, and the game mechanics like rally steps will pull you back towards the neutral stance.
Now I'm curious, like, I know, Jesse and Paul, you guys jam a lot. Have you seen people use the stance meters as a tool for deciding how they roleplay their character, or seeing people kind of use that as if they're in an aggressive stance, maybe they'll describe their character, you know, like you said, in a crazed bloodlust? Or so I always wonder about tools, mechanic tools that can help players, like, kind of figure out how to roleplay. And I see, like, the stance meter as a nice tool to be able to do that.
There's a little bit of a misconception on what stance your character's in when you're not actually actively engaged in an encounter. You know, Paul, do you have any thoughts on that one before we touch?
A lot of when you're in story mode, you're basically neutral. And from my perspective, and it's a little more house rule-y than what the rules as written say, you know, that's when I take the role playing as stance.
Yes.
So if somebody is acting aggressive, but we're not in encounter mode, whether it's social or combat, somebody's acting aggressive, then I'll say, okay, you know, convert one or two of your characteristic dice in this social check to reckless dice. But conversely, what you're saying there, Jeremy, I have seen a little bit of that. I mean, it's stance is definitely tied to career, and career is tied to role-playing. So it's all kind of interrelated, and I know that we're it's a little bit artificial to break out these bits and pieces and talk about them each individual episode, because we're still talking about dice and we're talking about stance and careers. It all ties together really well, but I have seen some of that. Yeah.
You know, the house rule that I've always enjoyed was in non-encounter scenarios. So when you're in story mode, I've allowed the characters to be up to 1 point into reckless or conservative to represent their mood or their style. You know, that way it's not game changing, but it's enough to actually gain an effect and give a visual cue of what your character, or how your character is performing or acting. And it also forces them to commit to a style, and they can change it on the fly as the, you know, as they role play the scenarios, but it does give them a neutral, one aggressive or one conservative option.
And that's actually, so when a person has a career or has a stance meter that is geared towards conservative or reckless, then they're definitely picking actions based on that, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the more melee type characters are a little bit more usually conservative. The melee characters, the troll slayer being the reckless. Archetypical. I'm sorry, yeah. The troll slayer being the archetypical example of a reckless character, mm-hmm. right there. So, and their cards, the action cards that are associated with them, kind of represent that.
Absolutely.
I think just a couple things that I want to touch on the cards is that the cards have an inherent difficulty built into them as well. So certain actions, and this also includes spells that are harder than other spells, automatically have either misfortune or challenge dice built into that challenge. So for example,
that's meant to go on top of whatever else would be absolutely building into that pool.
Yep, absolutely. So if you're doing, so I've got Trollfeller Strike is in front of me right here. It's a pretty powerful attack. It has one misfortune dice built into the card itself. So no matter what else you're doing, you're always going to have that extra black die being rolled.
And generally speaking, most of the basic actions that all characters have do not have any detriments, or if they do, they're very few, to actually performing the action. It's all these more elaborate action cards are the times where you needed to start deciding whether or not it's worth adding, you know, two extra purple and a black to cast this spell.
Yep. So the other thing that I want to talk about is the difference of what happens when you do your test. So there's a test that's very explicitly listed on the card. It can either be like an opposed check, or one of the other keywords that they use is versus the target's defense. Usually that's in combat situations. The target's defense is going to be one purple die plus a number of misfortune dice equal to the defense of the NPC that you're attacking. So monsters have a defense rating, and then PCs can create more defense either through armor or through their active defenses. So the block, the parry, the dodge actually adds misfortune dice to that as well, and those come into effect when it goes against the target's defense.
You know, Paul, I'm glad you mentioned the versus, like, target's resilience or toughness, because that was something that I had been confused on for a while, and that sums it up nicely.
Yeah. So it is those basic things. It's either an opposed check, a check against the target's defense, or sometimes it's just a straight-up regular check. For example, channeling. When you're a wizard, when you're a spellcaster and you're trying to gather power into yourself, there's nothing that you're checking against. You just roll the dice. Now, channeling has a one challenge default difficulty to it, so you've always got some chance that something's gonna go wrong. But you're not rolling against your own willpower or something like that. So the important thing to realize is that there's two or more outcomes that happen once you actually complete your roll. There's a certain number of success lines that define, okay, if you get one hammer, this is going to happen. If you get like two hammers or three hammers, this is going to happen. And usually the more hammers you get, the better it's going to happen. The important thing to remember with this is that you can only pick one line. So, for example, if you have an action that has a success line for one hammer and another success line for three hammers, and you roll two hammers, you only get the first line. You don't get to take the first line twice. Right.
So this is similar to when you roll numerous blood, you're only ever going to get one fatigue.
That's correct. Yeah. So if you get three hammers, you can take the three hammer line or the one hammer line.
Can you take the two? So you can't take, like, if you roll three, you can't take the two hammer and the one hammer.
No, you cannot. You can only choose one success line.
Now that concept does not carry over into the dispersion of boons, comets, and all the other different
Absolutely.
Symbols. It's per symbol, essentially, is what you're saying.
Right. So you pay that stuff off. So, for example, if you have if you have multiple capabilities, remember we talked last episode about the universal effect for banes and boons. So if you get two boons, you can always regain one stress or one fatigue. So if you say roll four boons on a roll, you can spend two of those to do the universal effect of getting back one stress or one fatigue, and then you can pay another two to use one of the side effect lines that's on your particular action, and then you can even use additional boons to, like, do the critical rating for your weapon, things like that. So those are actually a pool that you can pay out of and have multiple effects go off of.
Very nice.
I think that's a perfect example of having, like you guys talked about last time, of a very simple dice system of you either succeed or fail, but the real it has such a layer of depth to it that you succeeded, but now you have all these choices of how do you want to spend your extra points or what do you want to do, and I think that's one of the real awesome aspects of the action cards.
Yep. So the last thing I want to cover is recharge, and there's a little bit of confusion about this, but basically what recharge is that you can't necessarily do every action every turn. Some actions can only happen after a certain amount of rest or recharge or things like that. And that's defined by the recharge that's on the card.
So now, are you saying that most advanced tactics would have a higher recharge than some simple move?
Yeah, absolutely. And even basic ones, like block, dodge, parry, those all actually have recharge built into them, so you can't block every turn.
I'm looking at a spell card here, which actually has a recharge of 9.
Wow.
You know, I mean, you're using that one once in a combat. If you know, you're probably not going to get that one off twice.
So once you get your head wrapped around recharge, it becomes very easy and very simple. When you successfully complete an action, you put a number of recharge tokens or a die face or something like that. You count basically the recharge that's there. And until all the recharge tokens are off of that card, you can't use the card again.
And generally speaking, you remove one at the beginning of each of your turns, and then potentially
nope.
There are...
You're wrong.
Oh, I'm wrong? Oh, no.
Sorry. Ooh. It's at the end of your turn.
At the end. Oh, that's close.
The very last thing that you do before you say, I'm out, next guy goes, is you remove one recharge token from every card. So, if you, for example, play a card on your turn, and it's got a recharge of 2 on it, you put down the card while you're playing the turn, you put 2 recharge tokens on it, and when you're done with your turn, you take one off right away.
Okay. And there are a lot of spells and a lot of abilities that can actually tweak the number of recharge tokens that sit on cards, and a lot of them can either feed off of them positively or negatively, for that matter.
Right. So that's that ongoing trait that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Some things have a continuous effect. So, for example, with the session, you had a burning armor
right.
Spell that was cast by the Bright Mage.
Right.
That card had an ongoing trait on it, and while that card was recharging, that's for how long the armor was being heated on the war gold.
And for those of you not unfamiliar with what Paul's talking about, he's referring to our introductory session, A Day Late and a Shilling Short, that we recorded about a week ago.
So going back to that idea that you remove one token every turn, including the turn that you play it on, if you notice, there's no cards in there that have a recharge of 1. Because a recharge of 1 is exactly the same as a recharge of 0, because at the end of your turn, you just take that recharge back off and you'd be able to use it again. So really, the recharge number, if you want to look at it a different way, is every X turns I can use this action. So if you have a recharge of 2, every 2 turns I can use this action. Every other turn, basically, I can use this action. 3 is 1 every 3, 4 is 1 every 4, etc.
Well, it's good that you pointed out that you do remove it the turn you cast it. That's an important difference that I overlooked.
Yep. Yeah. Very important to remember that. So, I think that about does it. Anything else you guys want to talk about action cards?
Nope. Or? I think you got everything.
They're pretty.
All right.
Yeah. They're pretty.
I like them.
I like them a lot.
And there's and the other cool thing is that the Creature's Vault included action cards for the GM for all the NPCs. So you've got everything right there. And there's actually some stuff in the Creature's Vault that says you can take your NPC deck of cards and just shuffle them and pick some guys out. It's like, oh, here's a dark elf. Okay, we'll make a dark elf encounter. And then you shuffle the action cards, and it's like, oh, here's Breath of Fire. Okay, what can I do around Breath of Fire and stuff like that? So there's even a little bit of interesting things you can do with it as a deck of cards.
Oh, for like a random encounter generator almost.
Exactly.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool.
All right, so we're going to take another break, and when we come back on the other side, we'll do our main topic, all talking about Tuzinch.
Tuzinch.
Evil!
This thing's a very evil.
We're back. So here we've got our main topic for episode 3, the first one that we're going to talk about, kind of getting into the lore of the Warhammer world. There's such a rich backstory to it, and one of the things we talked about at the top of the podcast is that the big bads that are out there, the 4 Chaos Gods. Now, I know a lot of our listeners are very familiar with Warhammer, and hopefully we're going to be able to not only drop some knowledge on those folks, but the new folks as well. And I think I'm going to hand it off to Jeremy, because I think you're our resident wizard of Zinch.
Yeah.
So.
Hey, Jared, do we want to maybe, before we even begin tapping into the power that is Zinch, is maybe just very, very briefly talk about what the four Chaos Gods are, and then what Undivided is. Because the Undivided one is that is not not talked about a lot, and may be a little confusing to some new players.
Yeah, sure. Like Jesse said, I mean, basically you have the four Chaos Gods, and each god represents, I guess, an archetype, and that's both thematically an archetype, but also how they're played in the game. And just like a quick rundown, you have Khorne, who is the militant, the war god. Usually the followers of Khorne are berserkers. They're chaos warriors who thrive on battle. You know,
heavy metal.
Yeah. Khorne sits on a, you know, a throne of skulls. You know, more blood for the blood god, more skulls for the throne of Khorne. You know, is a chant he's been known to say.
Skulls for the
and
skulls.
His, and his typical color is red.
Red, exactly.
And bronze.
I think I saw Marilyn Manson as one of his friends on Facebook, so I wasn't sure, you know.
Exactly. He's a bad damage gemma, basically. And then
so Khorne is, I think Khorne's arguably one of the most popular Chaos Gods. You'll hear his name.
Definitely.
Just about everywhere.
Definitely, like you said, one of the more well-known, you know, well-known of the four.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Nurgle, who Nurgle basically is the plague god. His greater daemon is the great unclean one, which is a pestilent-filled pus ball of awesomeness. And essentially,
damn right.
When you think of Nurgle, you think of plague, of disease.
Hygiene.
Yeah, Nurgle gathers all his power from decrepit decay. So usually followers of Nurgle don't smell nice, and they're, you know, they live in the gutter, and, you know, have a very sort of
they build on and feed off of the decay and inevitable destruction of the world.
Of all things, yes.
He's a very, very patient god.
Yeah. And then you have Slaanesh, which is one of my personal favorites. And Slaanesh, often people describe Slaanesh as the pleasure god, and he usually is prevalent in pleasure cults or courtiers, or, you know, he listens to your most secret desires, his greater daemon, the keeper of secrets, and he basically tries to fulfill your deepest, darkest wish. And usually Slaanesh and Slaanesh minions are, you know, as daemons go, the more attractive ones, I guess, as you'd say. So
they're asexual, typically, as well,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't say asexual is more
trisexual.
Hermaphrodite.
I guess you're probably right.
I think it's all the joys of being either sex wrapped into one, you know, one body, essentially.
See, which is why, Dan, I'd put Marilyn Manson in.
Oh, probably in that one. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
more than the Khorne category.
That's true.
Exactly. So, and then you have the one who we're going to talk about tonight.
Cool.
Who, it's a good kind of the look at Tzeentch in parallel to Nurgle, because Tzeentch also derives his power from change, but unlike Nurgle of the slow, decaying rot, Tzeentch is the great machinations. He's tied into plots and usually people who seek out Tzeentch are, you know, high-level politicians or sorcerers, because one of his key elements is that he's the most, one of the most tuned into magic out of the four chaos powers. You know, when you think of Tzeentch, you always think of sorcery.
Mm-hmm.
Arcane knowledge, you know, of, so usually a lot of followers you find him are, you know, people who are plotting, or he'll whisper to people who have, you know, these sinister plans.
So he's kind of like the great schemer, I think.
Yes,
was one
exactly.
of his accolades.
Yeah, the changer of ways, the great schemer. You know, often they say he sees all possible points of fate at any given moment. He knows everything that could possibly happen.
So he's always kind of got the ear of the politician. He's
exactly.
got he's looking to unravel the empire from within through
yes.
plot and scheming.
Yeah,
he can directly confront people, but usually you'll see him in the background, or not him, but rather his effects and his influences in the subplots of society.
He plays the long game.
Yeah.
He's the
absolutely
he's the
yes,
exact
psychological
embodiment
avenue. Yeah.
the embodiment of the butterfly wings, right?
He's, yes.
You know, he does one thing here where he trips a guy in a street in Altdorf because, you know, 10 years later in Talia, you know, this noble winds up.
So is that the actual identification of the chaos theory?
I think that is.
Yeah, I mean,
Jeremy,
yeah.
one of the things you talked on briefly, but I think you want to highlight is that the chaos powers don't get along. I mean,
no.
And that's kind
yeah.
of the reason why the PCs and the Empire and things like that actually have a hope in hell, because they don't get along with each other, and they're specifically paired up diametrically opposed.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, thankfully that's the case, because if you had four evil gods team up with each other, you know, it would be a pretty sad day in the Empire.
Which is essentially what happened when Archaon came on down. He had united the chaos gods and
will come on down.
Yeah, well,
now, you know, with the time.
I have a question. So, of course, you've got the four chaos gods, but what about the whole undivided thing? You know, I know that that plays a pivotal role, but how does that really tie all the gods?
Yeah, well, I'm curious to hear Jesse's take on the undivided.
Sure.
Usually,
go ahead. Sorry. Well, the chaos gods, you've got the gods themselves who are demons in their demonic realm, and they have a whole host of creatures at their whim, and they're also at the same time attempting to corrupt the mortal souls to gain a foothold in the mortal realm, and so that's where the cultists kind of come about. But that's also where you start building in things like Chaos Warriors and all those other tribes who were up in the north, very close to the actual like source power of chaos. Those tribes actually become worshippers of these chaos gods. Now, not every tribe out there necessarily subscribes to one of the four gods. Some of them have not chosen, some of them subscribe to chaos in general, and typically those type of characters are what you call undivided. Those are the ones who do not have any particular chaos allegiance, but are still chaos nonetheless. They're kind of your generic chaos.
Is that more like, just reading through the Creatures Vault, stuff like dragon ogres?
That could be, yeah. Essentially, most chaos gods, once they've determined that one of their followers or one of their demons is of suitable value, will bestow the mark of chaos on it, and then that creature is then essentially marked as a Nurgle demon or a Nurgle warrior. A creature who is unmarked by any of the chaos gods could very well be considered an undivided. Now, this is more a mechanic that's translated from the tabletop game than it is really in the role-playing game. Generally speaking, you're going to have a little more fun doing one of the four chaos gods. But if you want to have a generic chaos warrior, that is certainly a possible, and that would probably fall under the undivided category.
And you can also think of it as maybe someone who's newly initiated into the realm of chaos, maybe someone who's just been turned and they haven't yet ascribed, like Jesse said, to a specific power, or there's a great warrior who's being vied for by the different chaos powers. Mm-hmm. And like Jesse said, that mark of chaos often is then what goes with that is the power of whatever god you aspire to. So if you're a great warrior and Khorne, you know, turns you and gives you the mark of Khorne, he then will increase your physical prowess. You'll become stronger and faster. You know, Zinch, like who we're talking about today, he'd maybe like a sorcerer who's maybe a middling sorcerer who can't break that, you know, barrier, and he's not very good, subscribes to Zinch, and all of a sudden Zinch boons him with great magical power, you know, because mm-hmm. that's his realm.
And that's actually built into the game. So, we haven't gotten all four Ruinous Powers out yet, so we do have Zinch that's out in the Winds of Magic, and Nurgle who's out in Signs of Faith. And Zinch, the Mark of Zinch, is actually a condition that's bestowed, and it's basically everybody's a spellcaster. So
yeah.
if you get the Mark of Zinch, you're a spellcaster.
Mm-hmm.
So
even if you're a warrior.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and that was always something that was present in the tabletop game, is often characters who had the Mark of Zinch, whether or not they were a spellcaster to begin with, they were given, through that mark, a basic rudimentary ability to become a spellcaster, because that was the archetype of Zinch, is that he is the great sorcerer.
Exactly.
So this other thing we haven't really, or we're just starting to touch on, was that they have this mortal characteristic to chaos, then you also have this demonic characteristic to chaos. And through these two avenues, Chaos kind of has their physical and their spiritual forms, and they are constantly attempting to corrupt the mortal forms into becoming demons or demon hosts, or essentially trying to get their foothold in the mortal world. And Tzeentch actually has probably one of the most interesting roster of Chaos demons out there. I think we should definitely spend some time going over kind of what twisted creatures that they've come up with.
Definitely. I mean, I think when you're speaking of Tzeentch, anyone who knows them, you think of the horror, which, you have this, globule blue spooky guy running around who
Tasmanian
devil.
Exactly. Yes, with a very long tongue.
And if you're lucky enough to land a killing blow, he pops into two more ones that are of slightly happier pink color who still try to come and consume your face. So, I mean, they're one of the more, as Jesse said, the more fun, unique, and devilishly evil daemons in the Chaos arsenal, I think.
It's a fun one for the first encounter when you throw a blue horror at somebody when they finally kill it, that all of a sudden there's two pink horrors immediately following it. That's a nice little surprise when they think they're in good shape. So you can, for some gameplay mechanics, especially for people who are not familiar with Tzeentch demons, you can have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, it's a great way to see everybody go, oh, I killed it!
Especially if there's more than one, then you pop out four.
Oh, that would, that'd be horrible.
So then you've also got the Flamer of Tzeentch. That's another one of the kind of lesser ones.
Definitely, which is kind of like a horror, but basically from their sort of disembodied floating arms, they kind of like shoot flame at you. So, they're also pretty cool. And then you have Discs of Tzeentch, which are
kind of like a mount, right?
Yeah, basically how higher ranking Tzeentch Chaos Ballers get around is that, they fly around on these discs.
Well, and aren't the discs like trained and warped versions of the Screamer?
Exactly, the Screamer, which when you think of like a flying devil ray sort of creature, that there's your Screamers. So they're definitely a pretty unique set of daemons compared to some of the other Chaos Gods, that's for sure.
So generally speaking, also each of the Chaos Gods, they have their lesser demons. So not all of them have lesser demons, but they have the lesser demons, they have your kind of baseline demons, and then you have something called greater demons. And the demons we've talked about so far for Tzeentch are kind of the baseline demons, the more or less humanoid or horse-sized demons, if you were to encounter one.
Yeah.
But there's this whole category of greater demons, which are the serious monsters, and Tzeentch is certainly not short of those.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess you would say the archdemon, or the biggest of the greater daemons, is the Lord of Change, which follows kind of one of the animal characteristics of Tzeentch, which is, the bird or the avian. The Lord of Change has wings, and he's very bird-like, and not only has physical prowess, like you wouldn't want to get in a fight with him, but he, is a very powerful sorcerer, and
he's super cool.
Yes, very. I mean, all of the greater daemons in the Chaos Pantheon are all cool, and they all stick closely to whichever power they belong to. The Chaos archetypes are very thematic, and you see that a lot in the stylistic creation of their daemons, I think.
Super.
I think, we kind of talked about stuff from the theme standpoint. Mechanically, there's some interesting things that they do with it. So we've talked about stance before. Mainly these guys in the Tzeentch category, except for things like maybe horrors and discs, actually have multiple stances. So usually with NPCs, you have a fixed stance. So it's conservative one, or an orc maybe reckless one, or a black orc is reckless two, or stuff like that. But I'm taking a look right here at at the Lord of Change.
And he can be reckless and conservative at the same time if he wants to.
Yep, absolutely.
So he can choose on a whim which one is most effective for his spells that he's casting.
That's pretty nasty.
And that kind of
game mechanic representation of his ability to manipulate the change.
Of that ever-changing, quality of Tzeentch.
Now, typically, Tzeentch kind of follows a purple or a bluish color is kind of their theme, but also the multicolored fire. Fire is a big element in Tzeentch magic in particular, kind of evident with the flamers of Tzeentch, but these multicolored prismatic fireballs and flames are very iconic of Tzeentch as well.
Definitely. And
I think one of my favorite stories that I read in the lore, and I think it's in third edition as well, is this apocryphal tale of how Tzeentch was actually the lord of all magic, and he was actually ascendant over the other three chaos gods because he had all the magic. So they actually ganged up and took him on within the realm of chaos and hurt him and actually shattered his magic. And that scattered throughout the old world and throughout the multiverse and the realms of chaos. And each one of those shards is a spell. And Tzeentch is out there. One of his supposed long con games that he's doing is he is recataloging all of his power. So every time a new spell is found and he hears about it, he gathers a little bit more of that power back that he used to have when he was running the whole show.
Now, I have a question. Since you're talking about magic and he's a sorcerer, what are some of the magic cards that Tzeentch has in the role-playing?
Well, a lot of them actually, like I said, do deal with fire, fireballs or bolts of fire. Definitely, this prismatic fire is a very running, commonly running theme. But another one, a lot of it has to do with a lot of the spells have to do with twisting the mind of a person, making them either confused, making them perform erratically, essentially getting that whispering voice into their mind that somebody is pulling the strings of their life. That is a second kind of common theme within the spells.
And it's always from a game design perspective to see the feel of a thing or the lore of a thing, see how that then is instituted into the actual game mechanics.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I see here that one of my favorite ones so far is called the Gift of Chaos, and it's a rank 3 Tzeentch spell. And what it does is essentially temporarily gives the target, they start bursting into mutations and uncontrollably. And depending on the level of successes you get here, you can really almost turn this guy into a chaos spawn for a period of time as his body just completely erupts into disgusting mutations and then eventually fades away. But you can disable someone for quite a while.
Definitely.
Cool. Well, is there anything else that we wanted to wrap up with the
I think it might be a good
earnest power of Tzeentch?
Actually, I was thinking one question is, I'm not sure if maybe we fully went into it, but what are some of the characters in the game that you might see be affected by the taint of Tzeentch? What would most GMs probably throw out there?
I mean, I think that's definitely a good idea to look at, and I think that there's so many opportunities you could do. I mean, you could go on a small scale. You could have local mayors who have delusions of grandeur, maybe in a burgermeister or a local kind of politician who, is trying to fight his way to the top, and there's just no way for him to go anywhere, and then Tzeentch whispers into his ear, let me help you become, emperor. You know, that's one way you could go. You could go, since he is a sorceress god, you can deal with...
Now, of course, we have to throw in there that Tzeentch just doesn't say, here, let me help you be emperor. It's, I'll help you be emperor if you do the following for me.
Yeah.
There's always a quid pro quo here where...
Oh, definitely.
They want something in return, and it's usually not good stuff. But the promise of power is usually too strong to...
And you may not know about it. I mean, he's the X-Files yes. guy. He's the conspiracy guy. He's the guy of the wheels within wheels within wheels.
Now, I would suggest, and I'll throw this out there, I think trying to weave Tzeentch effectively into a game is probably the most difficult of the Chaos Gods, just given the sophistication of Tale and management of characters that you would need to do. It's certainly not impossible, but on a large scale, it's a toughie.
But I think sometimes, Jesse, you can fake it. You can just go inscrutable.
Sure.
You know, it happened because it's the will of Tzeentch, and it isn't going to come to fruition for another 30 years. But thank you for doing it.
I think,
you know,
he would.
Why did I hand that girl that flower?
Yeah.
I don't know, but you know, her kid, because she's got the flower, she meets this other guy, they get married, they have a kid, and that kid is the ruiner of the world. You know, that's the Tzeentch ploy right there.
And I think Tzeentch works best with multi-part campaigns.
So you enjoying those crackers, Dan?
What was that? Crackers? I'm not eating crackers. Oh, no, I got planes flying over by. Yeah, that's what I got.
Tzeentch likes crackers.
Tzeentch loves crackers. Are you kidding me?
Polly want a cracker?
Yeah. But I mean, I think that if you can institute him well into those games, maybe your gaming group is going to do a long campaign, and maybe you don't even hint, but you know off the bat, this NPC is a follower of Tzeentch. And then you can drop those Easter eggs throughout the, you know, throughout the adventure. And granted, it is hard to put that into a campaign, but on the other hand, it can be the most fulfilling. Like when your players finally discover that this guy is, you know, Tzeentch has had his hand in the works the whole time.
Yeah, It is important to note that most cultists attempt to live, or at least put on the presence of a normal life and hide their cult. So you know, cool. any NPCs that you throw at your characters could very well be you could double up as a cultist who is trying to, you know, hide something. It is a very easy game mechanic to add bad guys or to give them the little hints to go chasing after a cult when somebody they knew turned out to be a cultist.
It gives a little bit more depth for the players to kind of really question that NPC. I mean, it's not like someone's gonna carve a cult symbol in their forehead and run around screaming that they're part of this cult, you know, but it does. When you meet this NPC character, it allows the players to really test their skills of asking specific questions to kind of dilute what type of cult they're in, or see if they hear any subtle hints within, you know, the words that are exchanged.
And generally speaking, a cultist of a power will have been branded, or will have some kind of markings that, or maybe even a mutation that they're covering up somewhere. So, you know, maybe the cultist gets killed, they don't know it's a cultist yet, but they search the body and all of a sudden start finding clues. There's a lot of these kind of hiding the elements of chaos on your body so you can still be sociable in the world is a strong characteristic of chaos.
You know, and there's
cultists.
And I think probably out of all the chaos powers, Tzeentch is the one who likes the mutations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's a very Lovecraftian-esque sort of thing that when fighting chaos, it's like the more you know about it, the more chaos knows about you, you know, and you run the risk of mutation. And that's one of the lovely things I've experienced myself in third edition is having my character all of a sudden become 6 inches taller and be stretched out and lose fingers and, you know. So it's
a tentacle.
Yeah, it's a dangerous evil to fight, and that's what makes it really a great bad guy.
It makes you almost sympathetic of how the witch hunters operate.
It does a little bit, especially when your characters are forced to play the role of their character and not the bunch of friends who are playing at a table. You know, we're like, oh well, dude, you're a mutant now. I'm not sure how I feel about that. You know, I might have to kill you.
Yes.
Very good. So we're just touching on the first one. We'll be doing the other three throughout the next episodes and getting more into the lore of the Warhammer world as well. So really looking forward to that. But I think we're going to take a quick break right here, and then on the other side, we'll wrap things up with the questions and answers. Okay, and we're back. So we're going to wrap things up with questions and answers. And the first one I'll take, it's a question that's come in from perhaps more than one person we've heard over the last week. Shouldn't toughness be included to soak for total damage reduction in combat? Jesse, why don't you take that?
Dun. No comment. No, that, you know, you guys are absolutely right, and it's that was an oversight of mine in our play sessions where we just got caught up in having a smooth game. And you're absolutely right; the toughness does get added to your soak value for total damage reduction, which you know, in relation to the games we play, would severely reduce the lethality that some of our characters were exposed to, or that our characters dealt in the combats. So you will still, I apologize for that oversight. You guys will get the benefits of it continuing for one more full session before we rectify it, since we've already have one more session recorded and ready to roll.
Pre-recorded in front of a studio live
audience.
That's
right. And we had a laugh track and everything.
but I think that's actually, so when I was digging into that, so when I heard your guys' session and I said, wait a second, that isn't right. I actually went back and learned another thing. In some of the effects, especially, you know, talking about those action cards and the effects, there is a specific difference between an effect doing damage and an effect doing wounds. If an effect does damage, then damage reduction comes into play. If an effect does wounds, it's straight to wounds. It does not go through soak, does not go through toughness, does not go through damage reduction. It just does a wound. Now, critical wounds convert, so you have to do the wound first before you can convert it to a critical wound. But that's something that I need to pay attention to next time I play.
And just a small tangent to kind of tie up that one one comment which was pointed out by, I don't know, at least a dozen people, and we appreciate that. The Map Tools games we do tend to kind of play with some house rules, and also tend to either not use a couple rule elements or in order to keep the flow of the game moving quickly. Now, obviously, a rule like this we did not intend to miss because this one's pretty significant. But just wanted to throw that out there for those of you who do listen and wonder why we don't use something like a party sheet or a couple other elements. And you know, maybe that's a topic we can talk about at some point when we tap into map tools a little more. But I just wanted to throw that out there. So on to our next question. This is a question from Twitter.
A question.
That is what we will call it.
I saw a Twitty cat.
So a question from Luke Nyland. I'm liking what you're saying about it being less mathy, but do the symbol dice take away from the ability to take advantage of certain things like sneaking up on someone for a plus 30%?
I'm lost. Sorry.
What? So I think. I think what he's saying is you know, how do you interpret a plus 5, plus 10, adding 5 to the target number, minus 30%, those sorts of things. And the tools are right there. I mean, it's
your fortune and your misfortune dice. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I mean, like I kind of equate the rough and quick conversion for these kind of percentile things, which come into play a lot when you're doing like a second edition conversion, is, you know, kind of like one white dice per 10% or something like that's very appropriate.
It's actually, so white dice and black dice have an equal chance of a challenge or a success. And it's 1 out of 3. So it's basically, it's 33% if you roll one white die. But if you roll 2 white dice, there's an 88%. If you roll 3 white dice, that's a 98%. So, you know, getting into 2 and 3 dice, you're basically guaranteeing an extra success or an extra challenge to your roll. And then you throw challenge dice on top of that, and then that's even tougher.
Yeah, good point. The third question is from Simon in Germany. Sometimes I feel like play is directed too much by the rules, specifically rules for social engagements. How much do you rely on role-playing in a social encounter, and how much do you use the dice?
Wunderbar. I'm sorry. I got carried away on that.
So, I think it's really up to your play styles. I mean, Warhammer 3rd Edition has the mechanics in it to do social encounters. And combat is pretty much a standard for all RPGs. I mean, everybody knows about combat. You go into this different mode. But with Warhammer specifically, the idea of social encounters is something that's a little different. And it's not necessarily necessary for every time you do a social encounter, right? If you're haggling over a sword, you know, you're in town, you're at the weaponsmith and you want a new sword. Do you need to go into a full social encounter, roll initiative and all that kind of stuff and do the rolls? Or do you just state your case, that adds modifiers to the die roll, you do a quick die roll, and then you figure out what
I found it really useful for is different types of players and different skill levels of players have different comfort levels of how much role playing they can get into. You know, am I able to like first person talk my character up, or am I going to be talking more in a third person? Like, oh, my character goes up to the weaponsmith and he starts bartering for a new sword.
Yeah,
this different comfort level what Fantasy Flight, I think they kind of done, is allowed for the people who want to role play it out. Yeah, go for it. Role play it out. I'm not going to require you to use the cards. I'm just going to, you know, whatever you tell me, it'll happen. Let's do it. And but if somebody is not comfortable going through the actual motions of acting it out, they can rely on the actions that these cards provide to kind of give a description for what their character will do with a series of effects that'll happen.
Yeah, it
kind of allows you to go back and forth and choose which ones you want to use.
I have to agree with you, because I had to do that too, because I'm a very good actor, but unfortunately when I'm being called out on role playing, yeah, very kind of tough. So
I can't do the first person stuff very well at all. I like to do the third person stuff, where I just describe what the character does in more of a general sense. And so for me, the cards and the rolling is a little more appropriate, but I do not like to bog down a social encounter with a lot of rolling. A social encounter will typically involve maybe one roll at the end, once both arguments have been presented and it's time to make the decision of success failure, I'll do the roll. I tend to shy away from a lot of actions and social encounters unless the player decides they want to use one.
Yeah. And I think that's the area of the game which has the most room for, you want to talk about house rules or for the game master identifying what type of players he has, and then maybe if he's got a couple of players who love to do banter or talk it up, maybe you'll have them, you let them go first person, or, you know,
yeah,
I think
like that's... Jeremy, you're much better at the first person stuff, and you you let it fly sometimes and it's great, but other times, you know, like other players like Dan or, you know, some of our other friends don't have that same comfort.
Well, I mean,
level.
In my mind, that's the hardest part of role playing, is what do you do when you first enter a town? You know, you're not rolling dice, you're not attacking guys, it's much more free form, and I think that can be, you know, a good aspect of a good GM is identifying kind of who his new players are and trying to find
exactly.
That happy medium of, you know, how much should I let them do what they do? How much should I push them in the right direction?
Well, it's also nice because they're allowing you to kind of push, as you said, push you in the right direction, but it starts to warm up where then those players that were maybe uncomfortable in the beginning, they start seeing, oh, okay, well, that's how you do it. So then they start doing their role playing, like, all right, I'm going to roll up to the, you know, the armor smith, I'm going to grab him by both sides and say, listen, you give me my damn shield. You know, I mean, you can get creative, but people do warm up. And I think that is a good thing for a GM to kind of figure out who they have in their gaming group.
Indeed.
So. But don't discount the social encounters because, you know, as we've seen with Warhammer, not all careers are combat careers. So giving a person that opportunity to shine, to be able to use their actions that they've spent their hard-earned advancements or character creation on, and, you know, it's not hit points, but it's a progress track to see if the Liege Lord believes you or things like that, there can be a lot of drama and a lot of real satisfaction for the non-combat characters if you do pull out those tools and you do go into the full-on social encounter with fellowship based initiative and all those sorts of things as well. So
I think like you said, they're meant to be used, but not used in every single social encounter.
No,
it's meant to be used for
absolutely.
The plot specific ones.
Yeah.
All right, and then our last question from Bob Hanks. Would you happen to have any recommendations on Warhammer Fantasy novels?
Yes.
Well, yes.
And the end.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Have a great night. No, there's two actually. Again, after really getting into the role-playing, I used to play a lot of Warhammer Fantasy and 40K. Didn't really read a lot of the Black Library books, but just started to get into them. There's two really good ones that I just finished, The Sword of Vengeance, which I thought was a really, really good book, and I had then just bought The Sword of Justice. So, if you're looking
and
for...
What are those both... I mean, not really a plot summary, but kind of what kind of characters, what setting are those in?
To not give up too much, the Sword of Vengeance, it basically takes place in Everland, which is set aflame, and, you know, there's corruption, and an army of cultists basically rise in the corrupted city of Averheim. I think that's Averheim.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Abraham, something like that.
Yeah, so there's a theologist Volkmar who marches to kind of figure out the rebellion before it grows to a widespread defeat. So it's a really good book. I don't want to give away too much because you really got to read it.
No, that's perfect.
But that's the thesis of it, and it's a really good sit down read. So
yeah, I would add a couple too. The probably two of the most famous Warhammer characters. You have Gotrek and Felix, which is
I was going to say that one
the
too.
Dwarf Slayer and his stalwart human companion. And there's some great omnibus, you know, huge collections by William King, and both all those stories are great. And those omnibuses are really good. They're on Amazon, where it's all the stories collected in giant volumes. And
I think they even have the most current one of that series available on audiobook.
Yes, they do. And Paul will hate me, but you can buy them as ebooks. So for all you iPad people, you can get them on your iPad and look very stylish. So,
and sorry, also Paul, we love you, buddy. There's one called The Conrad Saga, which was some of the early novels by David Fairing. And those are kind of are a little harder to find. You might pick up some used ones from Amazon or whatever. But if you're interested in the Empire and Chaos, that series, it's a trilogy, would be a good read too.
My last suggestion would be if you want a little sampling of everything, there's a great book I picked up from Borders, and you can probably get it online anywhere too. It's called Tales of the Old World, and it's a series.
Yeah, going through that one.
Yeah, Paul,
too.
You and I both had it once, so I figured we'd cover both our bases. It's a series of short stories of the Warhammer world, and I think there's about 15 of them or so, and each of them's about
50 more than 15,
oh really okay
I think. Yeah,
some are
yeah,
shorter well, than I thought then.
It's a thick book, yeah.
It is. And the it gives you a little bit of Bretonnia, gives you a lot of Empire, gives you a little bit of Elves, a little bit of Dwarves, and it really covers a lot of bases. And if you're looking to get a general feel for Warhammer in a little more digestible format than a full novel, this might be a good option or an alternative.
That's a good bathroom book, absolutely.
I may or may not have mine sitting in my
bathroom. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think I can dedicate an hour sitting on the bathroom to finish about 6 chapters, so.
All right, I think that'll wrap it up for this episode of the Reckless Dice Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next episode. Please feel free to leave a comment for us on our site. It's recklessdice at Rorschach, RORSCHACH.net. Send us an email at recklessdice@gmail.com, and you can follow us on Twitter on @recklessdice. And please do give us a review on iTunes as well. We've gotten some good feedback from there, and we appreciate all of that.
And so, I think we're coming to Zune soon as well.
Yeah, I have. I know we've gotten a couple of those questions. I have submitted us to Zune. I may have to do it a second time or something like that, but I actually even signed up for it, specifically said, hey, it exists, so hopefully we'll get on there too. So, all right, I think that does it, folks. Say goodnight.
Okay, good night,
everyone.
Good night,
guys.
See you guys.
Okay.
Okay. Goodbye.